I would like to thank you for coming this evening to our event with Roger Walsh here at Miracle Distribution Center's presentation of its 15th anniversary speaker series. This evening we have a rare treat because Roger has brought a dear friend with him, Marika Arpaia, who's going to be joining us with some chanting music, and she will join us now and then a little bit later, and we're very blessed to have her. Let me tell you a little bit about Roger Walsh so that you'll all know about him. He is a professor of psychiatry, philosophy, and anthropology at the University of California at Irvine, and he has published more than 100 scientific articles and 10 books. Among them are Staying Alive, The Spirit of Shamanism, and a forthcoming book called The Paths Beyond Ego, The Transpersonal Vision. He's also edited 3 books of quotations on A Course in Miracles, Accept This Gift, A Gift of Peace, and A Gift of Healing. Dr. Walsh's writings have received more than a dozen national and international awards. Now, Roger is much more than all of this. To me, he is a loving friend and certainly a very loving and healing light in this world. And that's one thing we need in this world, is a healing light. And so without further ado, I would like to present Marika and Roger Walsh. Good evening. Is this one on?
Oh, good.
Okay, to get started this evening, some of you know each other and some of you don't. I saw you all talking beforehand. I'd like to introduce to you the chant that we'll be doing at the end of the evening. It's a special Sufi chant. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to sing it through for you a few times. And as I do, why don't you just say hi to the people next to you, if you don't know them or even if you do, and just send them a little warmth, compassion, loving thoughts, feelings. Just take a few minutes. You might want to stand a little bit, stretch your legs if you've been sitting for a couple minutes, and then once you've done that, then we'll go on and do a couple other chants together. Okay? May His peace abide in you. May His presence illuminate your heart now and forevermore. May the blessings of God rest upon you. Okay, now it's your turn. What I'd like to do is I'd like to get you all involved in singing. It's a way to kind of get you to open up and to get your hearts and minds and bodies all moving in the same direction. This first chant is called Om Namo Shivaya. It's very simple. Those are the only words. I'll sing it through once for you, and then we'll sing it all together. And then we'll see how it goes. Nice and strong. This is how it goes. Om Namo Shivaya, 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 Om Namo Shivaya. That was nice. Nice singing with you. This next chant, Roger asked for specifically. I think it's a favorite. The way this chant works, I sing a line and then you repeat it after me. So you don't have any words in front of you, but you never have to remember more than one line at a time. Okay? I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. Never completely dissolving in him, I always rise to dance. Never completely dissolving in him, I always rise to dance. I live in him and he lives in me forever. I live in him and he lives in me forever. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. Completely dissolving in him, I always rise to dance. Never completely dissolving in him, I always rise to dance. I live in him and he lives in me forever. I live in him and he lives in me forever. We never are apart in reality, but in fun we separate. We never are apart in reality, but in fun we separate. I live in him and he lives in me forever. I live in him and he lives in me forever. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. Never completely dissolving in him, I always rise to never completely dissolving in him, I always rise to dance. I live in him and he lives in me forever. I live in him and he lives in me forever. We
I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved. I am a wave of the ocean, my beloved.
Thank you.
Well, I thought it'd be wonderful to have an actual experience of some love and some loving energy before we started talking. It seemed like we might as well have. I couldn't think of a better way to kind of set a wonderful tone than to have Marika do that singing and that chanting. So thank you for joining in. A Course in Miracles makes a very remarkable claim. Actually, it makes innumerable numbers of remarkable claims. But the one I want to focus on to start with is in the lesson, There Is No Love But God's. And the Course says this: no course whose purpose is to teach you what you really are could fail to emphasize that there can never be a difference in what you really are and what love is. Love's meaning is your own and shared by God Himself, for what you are is what He is. If you achieve the faintest glimmering of what love means today, you have advanced in distance without measure and in time beyond the count of years to your release. That's quite a claim. Says that our fundamental nature is love, and that if we can experience this, that we'll be liberated. Now, these are remarkable claims, but they're actually claims which are echoed throughout the spiritual traditions of the world. All the great traditions emphasize the centrality of love and echo this theme. And it's the claim that one of humankind's most profound goals, perhaps even the most profound, is to experience, express, and ultimately to know ourselves as love. So what I'd like to do this evening is to explore with you the nature of love and the quest for it, what the great spiritual traditions teach about this, the similarities in the Course to what the great traditions say, and also, on top of this, the Course's unique contributions and emphases. Well, what then is love? Some of the greatest minds throughout history have wrestled with this question, and what they have not been able to define in a couple of thousand years, I am not going to try this evening. But what I would say is that love may be beyond definition, but it's not beyond experience and expression. It's something we've all felt, we've all touched upon. And all of us also have a sense that there are probably greater depths of it than we've touched, and that our lives are very much moved by that sense that there's something more we could touch. Because love is something that's universally desired, but in our culture rarely fulfilled. It's been a subject of song and poetry, the object of study by philosophers and sages, the quest of men and women throughout history, something that everyone wants, something that people literally live and die for, and that has shaped lives, cultures, and history. The Encyclopedia of Religion, this huge 16-volume set, has this to say about love. The concept of love, in one form or another, has informed the definition and development of almost every human culture in the history of the world, past and present, east and west, primitive and complex. It is perhaps safe to say that the idea of love has left a wider and more indelible imprint upon the development of human culture in all its aspects than any other single notion. Indeed, many great figures have argued that love is the single most potent force in the universe, a cosmic impulse that creates, maintains, directs, informs, and brings to its proper end every living thing. And this love that has been spoken of and has been the search of men and women throughout history has been both the source and the reason for existence and the expression, in particular, above all, of the great spiritual traditions. For Judaism, the simultaneous love of God and man, here is Judaism's first postulate and final inference, its point of departure and its destination, its root and its fruit. In Christianity, it's perhaps best summarized in the words of Jesus, "Love thy neighbor as thyself." And in Hinduism, Gandhi added, "And every living being is your neighbor." Confucianism, because of want of mutual love, all the calamities, hatred, and animosity in the world have arisen. Because of mutual love, all the calamities, hatred, and animosity in the world may be prevented from arising. Therefore, the person of humanity praises love. And in Buddhism, near the opening lines of the Buddha's teachings, there are the words, "Hate never ends by hate. Only love ends hate. This is the law, ancient and inexhaustible." But though love is much desired, it's also terribly misunderstood in our culture. And most people in our culture believe that love is something that we're passive victims of and can't control or can't direct. That the experience of love is kind of an intoxicated, delirious state of consciousness which descends on us something like an attack of epilepsy. That it's unreliable and fickle and something we get from outside. And our experience of it is dependent on having certain people in certain situations. You know, if a certain people who's just the right height and the right shape and talks the right way and looks the right way is with us and says the right things, then we can experience love. And most people view love as exclusive, that there's a limited commodity, and if I give some to you, I can't give some to you. And if I'm in a relationship with you, I better not catch you giving some to someone else. And it's viewed as conditional, so-called businessman's love. I'll love you as long as. And it's fundamentally based on a sense of separation, that at bottom, it is two individual, fundamentally, irreconcilably separate beings reaching across an unbridgeable gap to reach for and love each other. And that it is necessarily, almost invariably associated with anguish, longing, and pain. Sounds like fun, doesn't it? The reason it's not much fun, love as our culture conceives it, is that it is based on a tragic, unexamined assumption, which leads to a mistaken case of identity. People engage in a desperate, lifelong, and life-destroying search for love outside themselves because of an unexamined inner sense of inadequacy, deficiency, and fear. as the Course in Miracles says, the ego is quite literally a fearful thought. So given that, people search outside themselves to fill and compensate for what they feel is lacking within. The problem is, you can never get enough of what you don't really need. And this kind of search for this kind of love is inevitably associated with some sense of pain and loss. But for A Course in Miracles and for each of the great spiritual traditions, there's a very different view of love and its possibilities. Indeed, for the Course and for these other traditions, what our culture thinks of as love is actually a pseudo-love. What the Course calls an unholy relationship, what Buddhism calls love's near enemy. In Buddhist psychology, each of the most powerful and beneficial emotions, love, compassion, and sympathetic joy, which is joy in the well-being of others, has a far enemy, something which inhibits it, and for love, that's anger, and a near enemy. And the near enemy of these emotions is something which masquerades as it. And for the Buddhists, the near enemy of love, true love, is what our culture assumes to be true love. The Buddhists call it passion, that compulsive sense of emotional overwhelm. And you can get a sense of this when you're driving home tonight, if you turn on the radio. If you don't get a Christian fundamentalist who's breathing fire and brimstone into your car, you're likely to get someone singing about love, saying such things as, I can't live without you, I'm constantly thinking about you, when I'm with you I get all jittery, I break out in sweats and I can't sleep. These are the symptoms of heroin withdrawal. So love then, as our culture has conceived it, is much misunderstood, and from the perspective of the Course and the great spiritual traditions, is really only a shadow, a not fully developed form of what love can truly be, and it's often confused with craving. The Course and other spiritual traditions point to a very different possibility of love, which has gone by many different names. In Christianity, agape, in yoga, bhakti. For the Buddhist, it's metta, meaning loving kindness. And of course, it's a holy relationship. What's the nature of this true love, this metta, this agape? Well, to begin with, it's based not on a sense of lack, but on a sense of sufficiency and well-being and wholeness. So that it's not a craving to get something, but rather is born out of a desire to share. As the Course says, with love in you, you have no need except to extend it. And because it's not based on deficiency, there's no sense of dependency on other people or addiction to them. As long as we're dependent on getting love from outside, then we have to keep that person around so we can keep getting our fix. And you have to constrain them and constrict them because there are certain things you can't allow them to do. For example, you can't allow them to grow and mature because then they might figure out they don't need you. And this agape, this bhakti, is not experienced as a kind of delirious state, but rather what it's in psychological terms we would call a higher state of consciousness, a state of increased well-being and clarity, of inclusiveness of all beings, so that this love is not exclusive but extends to more and more people, more and more life, until ultimately encompasses all life, all beings, without exception and without reserve. And it's unconditional. It's not based on people's response. So that love can be expressed, the great traditions say and the great sages have shown, even under the most incredible stress. Perhaps the most profound example in our Western history, of course, is Jesus being crucified. Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. No attack, no aim at revenge, simply a wish for their well-being. And this kind of love is unitive. It doesn't see love as at bottom an expression of two fundamentally separate creatures reaching across an unbridgeable chasm, but rather recognizes that at bottom we are one being seeking to know and love itself. So we have then two very, very different images, pictures of the nature of love. What then is the role of love and the cultivation of love on the spiritual path? The great traditions divide into two somewhat different perspectives here. In some traditions, love is viewed as a vital, invaluable aspect of our being to be cultivated, developed, refined as fully as possible. But it's not regarded as the primary facet of mind and being to be developed. In Buddhism and Raja Yoga, the yoga of, or Jnana Yoga, the yoga of intellectual work with the mind, intellect, the love is cultivated, but it's cultivated secondarily to other practices. But in Bhakti Yoga or Christianity and Sufism, for example, the cultivation of love is seen as the primary practice of the path. And the claim is that to truly realize love is to experience awakening, salvation, liberation, satori, the many names that have been given it. It's perhaps best, perhaps wonderfully described in the words of Viktor Frankl, who was a Viennese psychiatrist who was interned in the concentration camps during the Second World War and had his family killed and came out of it with this conclusion that love is the ultimate and highest goal to which humans can aspire. The salvation of man is through love and in love. So no matter what the tradition, they all emphasize how vital it is to cultivate love, but place somewhat different emphases on it. Then there are also differences in traditions according to how effective their tools are for this cultivation of love. Some traditions give a wonderful vision of what love can be, but have lost some of the tools necessary to refine it. And I would make the claim that to some extent this is true of conventional Christianity, which has a wonderful vision of what love can be, but many of the contemplative practices, which were more central in the early centuries, for example, among the desert fathers, have been lost or not given the emphasis that's required, so that in conventional Christianity, there may not be the full range of tools and meditative and contemplative practices that are so helpful for the cultivation of love. Well, and how do we cultivate it, given that this is perhaps the most central of human emotions, given that this is fundamental for salvation, for awakening, given that it feels good? How do we cultivate? There are two complementary approaches. Then there are general and specific approaches. General approaches are practices which foster psychological and spiritual development across the board. That is, they just foster our maturation, our fulfillment, our evolution, without particularly focusing on love. Based on the idea that positive qualities of mind, love, compassion, joy, happiness, etc., tend to arise together, so that to the extent we mature and learn and grow, to that extent love will be cultivated, the mind will be opened, cleared, facilitated for the emergence and recognition of love.